Thank you. That covenant is part of what attracted me to this congregation. That's a really, really nice one. And I particularly like that idea that we will stumble, but we'll restore one another and begin again in love, because we will stumble. We will stumble, and sometimes we forget that. We think sometimes that our attitudes are so cool. We're so enlightened. We're so liberal. We've got it all, and people like us can't possibly make any mistakes. Really? Really? I like it. I like it. 3,000 years ago or so, the king of Israel had made a proclamation of liberty, that everyone should set free his Hebrew slaves, male and female, so that no one should enslave a Jew. And they obeyed, all the princes and all the people who had entered into the covenant, that everyone would set free their slaves. But afterwards, they turned around and took back those they'd set free and brought them into subjection as slaves. Big mistake. Because it turns out that freeing the slaves was not just some whim of the kings. The covenant of freedom was a covenant with God, who now sends the prophet Jeremiah to proclaim, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I made a covenant with your fathers when I brought them out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, saying, at the end of 6 years, each of you must set free the fellow Hebrew who's been sold to you. But your fathers did not listen. You recently repented and did what was right in my eyes by proclaiming liberty, each to his neighbor, and you made a covenant before me in the house which is called by my name." Sometimes we hear the term covenant used casually, as if it could be applied to any old agreement, any old contract. But in the ancient Near East, when people made covenants, they tried to make them holy. How? How did they do that? The expression karat barith, the words that Jeremiah used, mean to cut a covenant. To cut a covenant. The words were important, but it wasn't just enough to just speak to make a covenant. Cutting referred to the most dramatic part of the covenant ritual. Participants would split a sacrificial animal in two, maybe a goat, maybe a calf, and then walk together between the halves. What did this mean? Well, here's the Bible's God again, speaking of the covenant of freedom that the people had just broken. "Those who transgressed and did not keep the terms of the covenant which they made before me, I will make like the calf which they cut into and pass between its parts. All the people of the land who pass between the parts of the calf, and I will give them into the hand of their enemies. Their dead bodies shall be food for the birds of the air and beasts of the earth." Ah, the good book. Always good for some blood and gore. But the point is that in such a religious tradition, any promise worthy of the name covenant holds a lot of power, more than we might realize when we make it, break it, and we are sure to feel cut into, split, severed. But that's enough separation for the moment. Let's join together now as we hear Deborah's music. Thank you. Thanks so much. Well, I think you agree after hearing that reading that God seems pretty serious about people keeping that covenant that they've made to free their slaves after a certain period of time. That was, of course, that was the slavery in much of the world was like that. Slavery was for a period of time and not for life. What we had here was really unique, that actual transformation of persons into objects that could be sold and be slaves for life. That was pretty unique. Anyway, I'm also pretty sure that most of you noticed that this covenant applies to Hebrews only. We have to free our own kind, yes, but everyone else will need to wait till they get their own covenant or something. Still, it's a pretty strong beginning, a firm step in the right direction, taken long ago. Let's fast forward now to some more recent times. Let's travel almost 3,000 years from then and about 3,000 miles from here to February of 1777, to Massachusetts, the colony, and later the state that was the heartland for both Unitarianism and Universalism. While the American Revolution still raged, a religious battle was underway in the town of Gloucester. 16 members of the First Church of Christ were called before a council to explain their absence from Sunday services. I'm taking count here. The weather hadn't been too cold. The fighting wasn't too close to town just then. What do you people have to say for yourselves? Well, it turns out that these good souls actually had been attending services. They'd been listening to sermons in private homes delivered by Jonathan Murray, sermons on universal salvation and the love of God for all people. Jesus died for you, whether you like it, accept it, believe it, or not. Therefore, you will be saved to go be with him in heaven, whether you know it, like it, believe it, or not. Early Universalism. That's our real covenant, he said. It's binding, and it's inevitable, so why not enjoy it? Especially since it's also eternal. Let it put a spring in your step, a smile on your face, and God's love in your heart. And that had been what had attracted Murray to Universalism in the first place. He'd met the people in a congregation in England who were just, they were so light compared to the congregation he was used to with the hellfire and brimstone. It's like this lift. Well, let it put a spring in your step, a smile in your face, God's love in your heart. Well, that's a bunch of gooey hooey, said the worthies of First Church. Swallow it and you'll end up in that hell that you don't believe in. But in the meantime, you still have to pay your taxes to support the real church, meaning our church. Oh, and by the way, you're also suspended for delinquency, so though you still have to pay to support our church and our minister, you're not allowed to attend. How universally saved do you feel now? You should know that First Church in Gloucester was an old pilgrim church that was supported by taxation. Yes, that's how it was when we were a colony, said the Universalist, though it was more of an agreement than a binding covenant. But things are changing now with the redcoats getting walloped by the blue. We don't think we owe a penny. Plus, we've got our own ideas about where to put our religious dollars. You say, we're suspended. We say we're starting our own church. Forget the taxes. We're not paying, and you can't make us. First Christian Church sat quietly for a while, sort of stewing under its steeple. Fast forward again, just a few years to 1780. A new nation called the United States of America has come into being, and Massachusetts is one of those states. Now the Universalists meet in a donated building and play hymns on an organ captured from a British ship by an American privateer. Kind of a nice word for a pirate, isn't it? That old renegade preacher, Jonathan Murray, is the pastor. George Washington himself had commissioned Murray as chaplain to the Revolutionary Army. His relief efforts during the war had saved Gloucester from starvation. So you'd think its good citizens would give his church a break. But no. First Christian Church said, okay, go ahead and play your pirate organ in your little pirate church, but you still have to pay to support us. We're the standing order church, the real church, with roots in pilgrim times. For 3 years, the Universalists refused to pay the tax. At first, things were quiet, and then suddenly, the possessions of several Universalists were seized, including the anchor of one member's ship just before it sailed. Another member was put in jail. This was serious business. A court battle ensued in which the Universalists made their own case based on the new Massachusetts state constitution. That's a very important document. It's the world's oldest constitution that's still in effect. Most of it written by John Adams, a Unitarian who would later be our second president, 7 years before the U.S. Constitution was ratified. It provides us a glimpse at the state level of some national ideas that were still being worked out. The Universalist case in Gloucester provided an important test case for those ideas. Article 1 of this world's oldest constitution should sound familiar to you. I'm going to need a sip of water because these are 18th century sentences. They're pretty long. All men are born free and equal and have certain natural, essential, and unalienable rights, among which may be reckoned the right of enjoying and defending their lives and liberties, that of acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, in fine, that of seeking and obtaining their safety and happiness. We'll visit this article again in a few minutes. It sounds so normal to us now, and it's easy to forget how revolutionary, free, and equal sounded at the time. Article 2 deals with religion, so Adams turned the work of drafting it over to prominent members of the Protestant clergy, who wrote, "It is the right as well as the duty of all men in society to worship the Supreme Being, the great creator and preserver of the universe, and no subject shall be hurt, molested, or restrained in his person, liberty, or estate, for worshiping God in the manner and season most agreeable to the dictates of his own conscience, or for his religious profession or sentiments, provided he doth not disturb the public peace or obstruct others in their religious worship." So, do worship God, but don't disturb the public peace or obstruct others in their worship. These words were originally followed by a provision that would have done just that. The first draft started, "Good morals being necessary to the preservation of civil society, and the knowledge and belief of the being of a God, his providential government of the world, and a future state of rewards and punishments being the only true foundation of morality." Now, that's pretty much the opposite of universalism. Unfortunately, after heated debate, the pastors dropped this provision for an official state theology. But they were still undecided about whether or not there should be a state-supported church. So the Universalists focused on the end of Article 3 of the Constitution. "And every denomination of Christians, demeaning themselves peaceably, and as good subjects of the Commonwealth, shall be equally under the protection of the law, and no subordination of any sect or denomination to another shall ever be established by law. No faith will be set above any other." Well, the Universalists argued in court that this last clause should trump any requirement to support the established church if it did not teach what they themselves believed to be true. Ultimately, the courts agreed. This decision affirmed the religious freedom of the Universalists and other groups like the Baptists. It actually was a loss for certain Unitarian churches. Many standing order churches had gone Unitarian over the years, and they continued to receive tax support until 1833. So there are fellow Unitarian Universalists speaking in churches that used to be tax supported, state supported. But the decision affirmed something even more. It affirmed that this new covenant, the Massachusetts state constitution, had power to take us in directions we might not have anticipated when we first signed on. Remember Article 1 and its words about freedom. All men are born free and equal and have certain natural, essential, and unalienable rights, among which may be reckoned the right of enjoying and defending their lives and liberties, that of acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, in fine, that of seeking and obtaining their safety and happiness. Slavery in the new United States was not confined to southern plantations. Massachusetts was the very first colony where slave ownership had become established as a social, economic, and quasi-legal practice. In the early days, most ships that brought slaves into the colonies first sailed out of Boston. How does that work under the new covenant, which proclaims that all men are free and equal? Well, I guess the women just clap and sing hallelujah for the time being. Some people were quick to say, it doesn't. One Massachusetts slave ran away and was just getting set up on his own when his former master came to bring him home. He refused, and when the former master got aggressive, he also got smacked upside the head. Next stop, the courts. Moving gradually up from the lower courts to the highest one, where Chief Justice William Cushing wrote his opinion. More long sentences coming. As to the doctrine of slavery and the right of Christians to hold Africans in perpetual servitude and sell and treat them as we do our horses and cattle, that, it is true, has been heretofore countenanced by the province laws formerly, but nowhere is it expressly enacted or established. So there's no law, and certainly no covenant that sanctions it. Nothing like the covenant that we've just bound ourselves to keep. Slavery, he said, was an old world idea that slid in upon us by the example of others, but, Cushing continues, a different idea has taken place with the people of America, more favorable to the natural rights of mankind and to that natural innate desire of liberty with which heaven, without regard to color, complexion, or shape of noses, he gets right to the body, right? Without regard to color, complexion, or shape of noses, has inspired all the human race. And upon this ground, our constitution of government, by which the people of this commonwealth have solemnly bound themselves, sets out with declaring that all men are born free and equal, and that every subject is entitled to liberty, and to have it guarded by the laws as well as life and property, and in short, is totally repugnant to the idea of being born slaves. And so, the first colony where slavery had been established became the first state where it was abolished by law in 1783, 80 years before the Emancipation Proclamation. The court based its authority on a covenant that was at once civil, rational, natural, and sacred, with which heaven has inspired all the human race, a single, undivided human race. Jeremiah's heaven-sent covenant in the Bible is a covenant to free people who look like us and practice the same religion. Though it also appeals to heaven, this new covenant, the state constitution, takes us far beyond the Bibles. Documents like this go farther than the Bible in their power. Freedom is not just for people who look or pray just like us. It's for everybody. I imagine that some of you have felt uneasy listening to some of the words that I've shared from the world's oldest constitution. And I can assure you that later amendments have long since made it clear that Massachusetts is not a Christian state. But we often hear church and state questions discussed in all or nothing terms. Everything about who we are as a people depends on the Bible and its worldview, or else nothing does at all. I'd like to get beyond this either-or thinking and suggest a different view. I think our nation's founders came to their work bearing many gifts. Among these were Enlightenment teachings about humanism, reason, scientific methods of discovery, and discourse. But they also brought the Bible's insistence on the power of covenant. There are some promises that go much, much deeper than simple agreements. Certain ones mark a change, of course, that takes us to new places where we might never have planned to go. Philosophers speak of a phenomenon called emergent properties that scientists also find useful. A theoretical mathematician writes, "A strong emergent property is a property of the system that cannot be found in the properties of the system's parts or the interaction between the parts. Emergent properties reside in the properties of the ensemble rather than in any individual state." So you might say that strong covenants have strong emergent properties, almost a life of their own. You could say that this new life emerges between the words of a covenant, its makers, and its keepers. I can imagine that some Massachusetts judges and citizens felt or believed that the power of their new covenant and the national one in the making might be enough to end slavery all on its own. Over the next 80 years, everyone learned that it would take a great deal more. We would have to return to the ancient kind of covenant that Jeremiah spoke of and walk the long walk between the halves of a body split into north and south. And yes, we are still walking that long and painful road, and our feet bleed every day. And no, a paper covenant is not enough. Covenants like the Massachusetts Constitution do not produce changes by themselves, but they have a special quality that's hard to put into words. Like Leo's mom in our children's story, how they promise helps make what they promise actually happen. The ancient practice of covenant making, rooted in religion, profoundly influenced the foundation of this country and the shape of its core documents. We need to admit this honestly. But this does not make the United States a Christian or even Judeo-Christian country or justify any form of state religion. Covenant formation is rooted in religious practice, but it's not the property of one religious group. Understanding its power helps us to grasp why, even to atheists or agnostics, and I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, our core documents seem sacred. They bind us to something greater than ourselves, a greater system that calls us at times to do more than we think we can. Even perhaps to make heaven an emergent property of how we treat each other here on earth. This is a covenanted nation, not a Christian one, and its covenants make that clear. I know that's bad news for some assertive Christians, but I've also got news for you. You ready? If you think the fact that the world's oldest constitution was drafted by a Unitarian and worked out in court by Universalists gives us some special claim on the covenant of freedom by which this nation claims to live, you're right. It does. And it also reminds us that we have a special duty to interrogate and deconstruct any and all structures of racism that remain embedded in our institutional life. We have a special claim, a special responsibility, and a sacred duty. Covenant by covenant, that's how we make our way from ancient times until today. These covenants may or may not refer to any god, but if they aren't sacred, then I don't know what that word means. We're bound in a covenant of freedom. I hope we're bound for glory. The path is here before us, between two halves of a severed whole. The sutures that will help stitch it all back together. Maybe that's us. Maybe that's us. We'll see. Let's give it our best. Amen.